heading for the shed which leans in against the back wall, the oak tree branches overhead stretching out across its roof as if it is trying to hug its old wooden friend. There's a cross behind the shed, between the wall and the oak's trunk, which Danny paints white every year. Why he wants to paint his dead dog's marker every year is beyond me, but he can be weird like that. Not caring if the decking is crumbling to pieces or that the front door hasn't been touched up in years, yet the dog's grave marker is kept pristine. Maybe if it had been my dog, I'd feel differently, but I never had a dog, or knew Danny's dog either. He died when I was a baby, when Dad was off fighting his war. I asked Mom about it once, what Danny's dog was like, why he regularly painted the cross, but she didn't answer. Something of interest had come on the TV and she upped the volume. I remember it well because it came as a bit of a shock, Mom ignoring me. I'm almost at the shed when I hear the sound of someone crying. Oh God, it's Dad. This must be where he goes to allow his pain to seep out. I don't want to see him like this, weakened to tears, sadness in his heart. But a good daughter would do what she could to help, so I open the shed door, dragging the words from my mouth. Dad? As my eyes adjust to the dim light, I see him sitting on a bench, head in his hands. I lay my hand on his shoulder and gently squeeze. Is everything okay, Dad? When he looks up, his eyes are so red it's like they've been dipped in wine.
It's nothing, love,
he says, shaking his head.
I was just thinking about your mom. Missing your mom.
Now my own eyes are filling with tears, but I rub at them, hoping to keep the floodgates closed. I cannot do this, sit and cry in a shed with my dad. It'll be all right, Dad. Mom isn't going to get better, but if we stick together and do what we can for her, we will get through this. My father loves me. Every time he looks into my eyes, I can tell.
I don't know what I would do without you,
he says, wrapping his arms around me and squeezing me in a hug. You don't have to worry about that, Dad. You know I'll always be here for you. Linking his arm, I lead him out of the shed and back up to the house. Where's Danny and Joanna? I say when we get back indoors.
You didn't hear?
Hear what?
Joanna was at the hospital all night. A scare of some sort with the baby. Danny called and said everything was fine. They're home now, but they're too tired to come over.
But she's okay?
As far as I know. Danny said there's nothing to worry about.
Making a mental note to ring Danny later, I do my best to distract my dad from his sadness. Nothing to worry about, I say. I'm starving over here, and there's nothing in the fridge. Nothing cooking? My father looks at me for a second, then laughs.
I have some steaks we can throw on the grill if you like,
he says. I don't like, so I don't answer, waiting for the next offer.
Or we could pop down to Benny's Bistro.
That sounds better. Benny's isn't the greatest, but I think Dad likes to go there because of the memories. The birthday parties, the four of us around the wooden table, red and white napkins, Mom smiling, Dad smiling, Danny's face covered in barbecue sauce. And me, thinking I'm the luckiest girl in the world when the waitress puts the Knickerbocker glory down in front of me. I don't eat them anymore. Leaving Benny's full of steak and cheesecake, I notice that Maxwell's Bakery is open, so I go in and buy a pecan pie for Bert and Elsie. This time, I won't be able to pretend I baked it. The baker has stickers on the box proclaiming ownership of the recipe, and anyway, it's quite a leap from Joanna's buns. They would never believe me. When we get back home, Dad decides to go to Sam's Bar down the road, where a couple of his friends gather most evenings to discuss how the Red Sox should be playing. Ever since Mom went into care, it's been his only break from the grim reality of his empty home. Waving him off, I cross the street and knock on Bert's door. The pecan pie is a big hit. Pecan is Elsie's favorite, apparently. I pretend I knew this all along and went especially to Maxwell's Bakery because they make the best pecan pies in town. Elsie was really impressed by my thoughtfulness. It made her happy, so I didn't mind the lie. Then I get an update from Bert. Things are still the same. Elsie's comfortable enough to stay in her own home, and for that Bert is grateful. All his sadness and anger is nothing compared to this one consolation, that Elsie is still at home. Lucky Bert.
I saw a young woman at the walls during the week, Bert says when I stand to leave.
He always calls our house the walls, not your parents' house or your house or anything like that, just the walls, as if the rest of my family have nothing to do with me.
Really? I say.
She looked like you. Same build, same color hair.
What do I do now? I can't tell Bert I sneaked in the side entrance because I didn't want to see him.
That was me, Bert. I forgot my key and had to go around the back of the house.
No, it wasn't you. You were there on Monday. This was the previous Friday. I wouldn't normally notice who was visiting who, only I was out in the yard at the time.
A woman who looked like me? She was probably just selling something, I say. Was Dad in?
If he was, he didn't answer. Besides, she was looking for you.
Me? How do you know?
Because she came across when no one answered, asking if I knew a Rebecca Wall, saying she needed to speak to you.
There is only one conclusion I can jump to here. Katie Collins was at my house. That's odd, I say.
She didn't find you?
Not yet, Bert. If it's important enough, she'll track me down. My heart is beating a little faster. Now seems like a good time to pop around to Danny. I'll say I came to see how Joanna is after her night in the hospital. And maybe, while I'm there, ask him if he knows anything about Katie Collins. After all, if she called at Dad's house, she may have called at Danny's. Though I'm sure Danny would have been straight on to me if she had. Wouldn't he?
Chapter 16. Danny stands in the kitchen in running shorts and nothing else. His hair is unaware he has company. It sticks out in every direction, framing a grumpy-looking face with swollen, half-closed eyes.
Didn't get much sleep last night, I say, taking up position on a high stool beside the island counter.
Danny's house is the total opposite to Bert's. It's all mod cons here. Everything is controlled by a keypad, with a button for music, another for closing curtains or adjusting the temperature, and lots more.
I did sleep, he says, for about 10 minutes.
Anyway, I came to see how Joanna is, not you.
She's fine. The baby's fine. We're all fine. Tired, but fine.
Good. I look around the room until he twigs that I have something else I want to ask.
Is there something wrong, Becca?
But now I'm fumbling with the zip on my hoodie, wondering if I'm doing the right thing mentioning Katie Collins.
What is it?
He says. His eyes are wide open now. It's about that girl. The one who's missing?
What missing girl?
He says, walking over to the refrigerator. He opens the door and reaches for the orange juice and is about to start drinking straight from the carton when I say, Katie Collins. Orange juice goes spilling down his hairy chest. It'll get sticky if he doesn't get rid of it quickly.
Fuck,
he says. I stand up to find some kitchen towel, but I can't see any. Can't find the button. And by then, he's walking out the door toward the bathroom. After a few minutes, he comes back, wearing a t-shirt and jeans.
Sorry,
he says.
What was it you were saying? Some missing girl, was it?
He pulls out a stool and sits opposite me. Katie Collins, I say.
What about her?
Well, the cops seem to think she's looking for me. Danny stares.
Why would they think that, Becca?
I don't know. I'd never heard of her until I saw her on TV. They were saying she was missing.
Next thing I know, the cops are in Maddie's telling me she was looking for me before she vanished.
I'm waiting for Danny to take charge like he always does, but he only stares straight at me.
Then he gets up and walks over to the glass doors, slides one open, and stands there gazing out over his yard.
Danny? He doesn't turn.
What?
He says. What do you think I should do?
He's already shaking his head as he looks back over his shoulder.
There isn't anything you can do,
he says. Then he goes back to staring at the apple tree at the bottom of the yard. Losing sleep does not suit Danny. He's going to be a royal pain in the ass when the baby arrives.
Did the cops say why she was looking for you?
He says. No, just that she's missing and they think she's looking for me. And if she gets in touch, I'm to let them know.
Who's looking for you?
Joanna says, bustling into the kitchen. I fill her in. Joanna seems a lot more interested than Danny does. Then again, she's had a good night's sleep in a hospital bed while Danny had to negotiate the steel chair by her side.
Are you okay? I say, placing my palm lightly on her bump. The baby's okay?
It's all good, Becca. I honestly thought I was in labor, but it was just a false alarm.
She nods towards Danny and puts a repentant look on her face.
Let's hope it's the only false alarm.
Don't mind him, I say. He'll have to get used to no sleep when the baby arrives. Danny comes back inside, takes his cell from where it's charging on the countertop, and checks the screen.
So she didn't call here? I say.
Danny glances up.
Who didn't call here?
Katie Collins. She didn't come here looking for me?
Of course she didn't. Why do you think she would?
Well, she called at Dad's.
She what?
His face darkens with anger.
Like it's my fault she went to Dad's. As if I'm deliberately bringing unwanted grief down on the man.
So Bert said. He says she called, got no answer, then asked Bert if I lived there.
Danny walks out of the room without saying another word, leaving Joanna and myself staring after him.
Well, that's a bit weird, I say. What's up with him?
Oh, don't mind him, Becca. He's a bit crabby lately. Missing a night's sleep doesn't help either.
After 20 minutes of listening to Joanna's account of her night in the hospital, I decide to leave. Danny hasn't come back. Joanna says he's probably on his computer in his man cave, but I don't know. I think I pissed him off. The evening traffic is a nightmare, and it takes me more than an hour to get back to my apartment. I knock on Jeff's door but get no answer. Looks like I'm on my own tonight. Standing by the window, I look up at the darkening sky, wishing Jeff would call me up, ask me out to a movie or something. Anything to take my mind somewhere else for a while. But Jeff doesn't call. Bert does. Edith has been taken into hospital.
Chapter 17. Bert is holding Edith's hand. Edith is holding Bert's heart.
I'm holding back the tears.
I hate this part. This part of life. Death. The part when everything enjoyed or hoped to be enjoyed loses its value. The what's it all about feeling.
I wonder about it. Too often, maybe. The power of loss.
Bert puts his lips close to Edith's ear.
Rebecca is here, Edie. She's come to see you.
His tortured eyes turn to mine.
I don't even know if she knows I'm here,
he says. She knows you're here, Bert, I say.
Even though I have no idea if Edith knows Bert is here or not.
It doesn't matter. Lots of truths no longer matter. Edith is on her way out, and Bert is going to have to hang around a bit longer in this world alone. It's important that he thinks Edith can hear him. It matters that he gets to tell Edith a million times how much he loves her, how much he has loved her, how much of his world was built by her, and how happy he is that it was.
I place my hand on Bert's shoulder and feel the bones, a carcass beneath his sweater. His face has shrunk, sucked in like all the fat has melted and only the skin remains. Bert looks sicker than Edith. That can happen to people. One big shock can literally drain the life out of them. I saw it happen to Dad when he walked out of the hospital the day Mom's diagnosis was confirmed. I was living in a different part of the city at the time, not far from the hospital. Dad rang and asked me to meet him there. I didn't rush, presuming he was looking to kill some time while he waited on Mom to finish more tests. I didn't know he'd just been told his world was about to change forever. I remember being annoyed at getting damp in a light shower of rain as I made my way toward the sliding doors at the hospital entrance. The doors that opened and closed, opened and closed. People were going in, anxious about what they would discover today. People were leaving, some happy, others not giving anything away. Then I saw Dad standing to one side in the lobby. He was giving everything away. His whole shape had changed. It was as if he'd been squeezed by a giant hand. I rushed towards him as slowly as I could. Back in Edith's room, Bert is sitting on the only chair, so I hunker down by his side. Can I get you anything, Bert? Some water? A cup of coffee?
I'm fine, Becca. And thanks for coming down. I didn't know who else to call. You can go now if you want.
I've only just arrived. I can stay a while, Bert.
No, I don't want to keep you here late. I just thought you might want to see Edith before... Before.
He tries his best to hold back the tears, but his best isn't good enough. I lean in and give him a hug. He needs more, though. He needs a miracle, but I don't have any miracles. I tell him I'll say a prayer for Edith. Praying isn't something I usually do, but hospitals have a way of making people reconsider their belief in the next world. I stay with Bert until a nurse arrives to tell him they will be moving Edith to a private room as soon as possible. Bert nods a thank you. He's humble now, humble and broken. Bending over the bed, I kiss Edith goodbye, wipe the tears from my eyes. I squeeze Bert's hand, unable to look him in the eye, then shuffle through the curtains and out into the ER. More sick people. I am sick of looking at the sick. Finally, I make my way to the reception area, where dozens of people sit waiting patiently to be called. Heading towards the exit, I notice everyone's eyes are fixed on the wall behind me. I glance behind to see what's going on, and I see her, Katie Collins. Her face is full screen on the big TV bolted to the wall. There's no sound, so I don't know what's being said, but I can read the words scrolling across the bottom of the screen. The room goes into a tailspin. My body seems to be shutting down. Katie Collins is dead.
Chapter 18.
Jeff! I yell, banging on his door, but there's no answer. Jeff must be out. He isn't answering his phone either. Shacked up with some new date, probably. Walking back to my apartment, the empty corridor seems eerie somehow. All I want to do is scream. Back in my own space, I flick from channel to channel. Katie Collins was discovered in Tree Hill Park, a public park not far from Dad's. We used to go there for picnics when I was a kid. It has a playground surrounded by forest. A big, lonely forest. Danny went missing in that forest when he was a young boy. Or so we thought. After searching for what seemed like hours, but what Danny remembers to be just minutes, he poked his head out from behind a tree saying, "Fooled ya!" Mom and Dad were happy to see him at first. I remember smiling at him from behind their backs when he got chastised for scaring them. According to all the crime reporters, Katie's body was found by a man out walking his dog. The forensic experts are at the scene now. All the evidence points to a violent death. Hours pass. Still no sign of Jeff. I flick from one station to the next. Katie Collins' death is the lead story on every local channel. Funneling down coffee, I stay glued to the screen. What will happen now? Will Detective Turner think I'm involved? Curled up on the sofa, my body does not feel like it's mine. I'm an alien here. Jesus, Becca, how the hell did you get dragged into this? When the phone rings, I nearly jump out of my seat. It's her. It has to be her. She's gonna want to talk to me. I answer, expecting to hear her dull voice. But it isn't Turner. It's Barry, calling from Oak Ridge. He has the CCTV coverage I was looking for. Do I want to look it over tonight? Now I don't know what to do. I know what I should do, ring Turner and tell her I think Katie Collins visited my mom. But what if it wasn't her? What if the visitor was a different Katie Collins visiting someone else at Oak Ridge? Turner will go mad with me for wasting her time. She'll think I'm trying to mislead her, maybe slap me with an obstruction of justice charge. Right now, there's a knot in my stomach wrapping all my fears into one hard ball. Kick the ball, Becca. Kick the ball away. I need to see that CCTV coverage. I want to know if Katie Collins visited my mom. If she was the one who put those crazy ideas in Mom's head. I took you, Becca. You're not my daughter. There's no need for me to knock the building down this time. Barry is waiting by the door.
Are you okay?
He says as I slip past him, in behind the desk. I'm shivering. Coming back here has taken a lot more courage than I ever thought I had. I'm nervous about what I'm about to discover, but I believe I already know the truth. All I'm looking for is confirmation. It would be too big a coincidence if the visitor was some other Katie Collins.
I think this is the one,
Barry says. My head is ready to explode here.
I'll just fast forward to visiting hours,
he says. His voice is soft, comforting. He even handles the computer gently, pushing buttons like they might break under any pressure. Barry starts the footage running at 2 p.m. The picture is crystal clear, so it won't be difficult to spot her. A nurse opens the door to a young family arriving with a huge bunch of flowers. They're quickly followed by more visitors. Everyone looks as frustrated as I feel entering this place. They all present with worry scraped across their faces, putting on their polite smiles. I never considered the other people here. I always felt as if I was the only visitor and Mom the only sick person. I can be so selfish at times.
Will you recognize her?
Barry says, his eyes on the screen. I'm pretty sure I will, yeah. I will, Barry, and so will you. Her face has been front and center on every TV screen for the past 6 hours. Shit. I never thought of that. What's Barry gonna think when he realizes I'm stalking a dead woman? After watching people entering and leaving for over an hour, we've come up with nothing. No Katie Collins. I thought once or twice I saw someone that could be her, but when Barry zoomed in, they didn't fit.
Well, that's it,
he said.
You don't see her?
No.
And you're sure it was the 24th?
That was the day she signed the book, I say. I'm feeling deflated, even though I should be relieved. Thanks, Barry.
Hold on,
he says, pulling the visitor's book from below the counter.
Let me just check something.
He flicks through the pages. When he gets to the 24th, he reads through the list of names.
Katie Collins?
Then he turns the page to Saturday. It's empty.
Oh,
he says. My heart leaps. What is it?
Saturday's page is blank.
What does that mean?
It means that either not one person came to visit on a Saturday, which is unlikely, or that the page wasn't turned over onto the 25th.
So she might have been here on the Saturday.
Could be. Let's see what we have.
The clock in the corner of the screen is displaying 2:34 p.m. when I see her. Blonde hair tied back, wearing jeans and a pink sweatshirt. Katie Collins visited Oak Ridge on the 25th of October at 2:34 p.m. I was here that day. I'm here every Saturday. Christ, I must have missed her by a few minutes. Maybe we even passed one another in the corridor. My eyes lock onto the image. My heart races. This is her. Katie Collins. Moving closer to the screen, I scan every inch of her face, her neck, her eyes. Why did you come here, Katie? What did you want from me? With my eyes ingesting every detail, her shape steps further into the distance, away from the camera, closer to danger. Who killed you, Katie? It's pink. Baby pink. My heart almost jumps out of my t-shirt when I see it. The photograph hangs alone on the wall inside the door. Moving closer, I see a child sleeping, cradled in her mother's arms, wearing a tiny knitted coat. There's a little girl standing by their side, her face glowing with happiness, her smile showing the gap created by two missing teeth. In her hand, she holds a naked doll with painted hair and one plastic eye. The mother is also smiling for the camera, but there's a shadow across her face, proof of sadder times etched around her blue eyes. Her lips are bare, no makeup, no curls in the dark, graying hair that hangs in clumps to her shoulders. Her floral dress droops loosely over her skinny body. Her feet are bare. In the background, the sky is flawless, a painted blue without a cloud in sight. The door to the trailer is open, showing the mess inside. Clothes scattered across the floor. Empty cupboard doors ajar. A teddy bear. A burnt-out candle. On the wooden steps leading to the open doorway, a can of beer sits beside an overflowing ashtray, some of the butts dotted on the dry, dusty soil below. The baby is about 3 months old. A small tuft of hair jutting out from the center of her forehead. Her shiny lips are tightly closed. But it's the coat that scares me. The pink coat with the second button missing. Putting my hand on the frame, I glide my finger over the baby's face. Over my face. Chapter 19. I don't think I slept at all last night. My mind was playing games, wondering if Katie Collins spoke with my mom. Did she tell her why she was looking for me? Nothing makes sense, and I still can't figure out why she looks familiar. Maybe she reminds me of someone I once knew. I ring Jeff, but the call goes straight to his message minder. Where are you, Jeff? In the meantime, I better go back to work. Get this Stephen Black thing over with. Face the music. You're going to have to face the music, Mom used to say. I don't know where that saying came from, but I know what it means, having heard it a lot growing up. Like the time I broke my grandma's plate with the American Constitution engraved on it? You'd swear it had been presented to her by President Lincoln. Well, maybe not Lincoln, perhaps George Bush, the older one. She was a big fan of his. Anyway, uproar exploded when it broke. I ran out of the house and refused to return until eventually I was told I had to face the music. And then there was the time I was caught stealing in school. It wasn't much, just some coins one of the teachers had left in a drawer. After refusing to return to school for a week, kicking and screaming and making myself sick, I eventually had to return and face the music. And here I am today. Standing outside Bridgeway, about to go in and see Stephen Black for the first time since he threatened me. I don't expect music.
Taking a deep breath, I push through the glass doors into the foyer. My stomach feels twisted, sweat clammy on my forehead, and the elevator seems to be taking forever. What will he do? Will he even speak to me? Eventually, the elevator comes to a stop, and I step out into the office, the constant office. It's as if no one else bothers to go home at night. Like the space is permanently full of these people and I am the only one who comes and goes. The only thing different about it today is that everyone is looking at me. They don't even turn away when I notice. I, for some reason, am today's gossip. Oh, shit. I hope they don't know about me and Steven. But it's not that. It's her. Standing outside Stephen Black's office, Detective Ivy Turner and her partner, the tall, quiet cop. What the hell are they doing here? Stephen has a look on his face I haven't seen before. Most likely it's his, "Why the hell are the cops looking for you?" look. I'll know soon enough because he's heading in my direction.
"What have you done now?"
he says, under his minty fresh breath. "Nothing, honestly, it has nothing to do with me," he asks. No, orders me to follow him into a nearby room, one of the settlement rooms, while I continue my plea of innocence. The cops seem to think I know something I don't.
"Get rid of her quick,"
he says, leaving to get Turner and bring her to the room. Turner is ferocious in her questioning, wanting to know where I was at every given moment over the last week. As if I might be Katie Collins' killer. I'm not a killer, Ivy. I'm many things, but not a killer. Her hair is annoying me. The straight black fringe etching a line across her forehead as if it was painted on. It doesn't move even when she does. I don't like her jacket either. It's too casual for her important role. Her face, however, is gifted with perfect features. All sharp corners and piercing dark eyes, and her long, lean body looks fit enough to catch an escapee. She won't need it today. I'm not going anywhere. I have nothing to hide.
"I cannot impress on you enough how important it is that you try to remember every little detail. Anything at all that might help us find out what happened to Katie."
She says, "Katie, Katie, Katie," over and over again, appealing to my tender side, making the victim human to me. But she's wasting her time. I've nothing to tell her. "I wish I could help you, Detective. I wish there was something I could say that would help, but I've never met the girl." Her eyes bore a hole in my head. I don't think she's even blinking. She makes me feel vulnerable, weak, in danger.
"What about your family?"
she says.
"Did you check to see if Katie tried to get in touch with any of them?"
"I mentioned it to my brother and my father, but they know nothing about her." Suddenly, I'm lying. I'm not telling her about Katie being at Dad's house. If she starts bothering him, Danny will blame me. And anyway, I don't even think Dad knows Katie was at his house. At least, he never mentioned it. The last thing that man needs is more crap to worry about. Mom's deterioration is enough.
"And your mother?"
"My mother is in a nursing home. She has Alzheimer's."
"Right."
Fuck. I'm lying again. Katie Collins was at my mother's nursing home, but I don't want to tell Turner because if she calls there, this whole thing will blow up and everyone will get dragged into it. People who have nothing to do with it. Or should I tell her? Maybe Katie was followed by the van that followed me. The killer could be working in the nursing home, and if I say nothing, it could stop them finding him. "I think she may have visited my mom," I say at last. Turner's eyes open wide.
"Why do you think that?"
My hands are sweating, trembling below the table.
"Rebecca, why do you think that?"
"Her name was in the visitor's book."
"When?"
"I saw it the other day. I think she was there last Saturday."
"Last Saturday?"
Turner sneaks a glance at her colleague, the quiet guy.
He's wearing a navy jacket and seems to stand by her side doing nothing.
Did you see her there?
She says. No, I didn't see her.
Why is she looking for me?
It's frustrating that she won't say why this dead woman wanted to contact me. Surely I should be told.
Did she speak to your mother or anyone else?
Mom is unable to communicate, and I don't know if she spoke to anyone else.
What's the address of the nursing home, Rebecca?
The bitch won't tell me why Katie Collins was looking for me.
Why won't you tell me why she was looking for me?
I say, sounding braver than I feel.
I can't tell you at this point in the investigation.
She opens a page in her notebook.
The address, please.
Then I see him, standing outside the glass-paneled door, staring in at me. His eyes are black with anger, lips pressed tightly together. For a brief moment, I picture him lying on top of me, his heavy breathing in my ear, his hands squeezing as he huffs and puffs his way inside me. Stephen Black is threatening me with his piercing eyes. He's making sure I don't mention his name. My heart is beating hard, and I think I'm going to get sick. I want to stand up. I want to run out of this place.
Rebecca, the name of the nursing home, now.
Oak Ridge Nursing Home, Braintree, I say, and watch her scribble it down. I need to get back to work, Detective.
Just one last thing, then you can go.
Shifting in the chair, I straighten my back, thankful that this is almost over.
Where were you last Saturday night?
The shape hovering behind the glass moves closer. Stephen's eyes are wider than a teenage boy's watching a woman undress. My head is going to cave in. I don't know who I fear most, my boss or the cop. Both are frightening the life out of me. I was working in Maddie's.
Until what time?
About 2 a.m.
And did you go anywhere after that?
No, I went home.
Is there anybody who can vouch for you? Were you with anyone else?
I can feel his eyes through the glass, drilling a hole in my honesty. No, I was alone. Chapter 20. I should not have left. Stephen Black will be pissed when he emerges from his office and discovers I've done a runner. But I couldn't stay. I'm sick of being treated like the bad person in all this, the one letting everyone down and getting everyone into trouble. This was not my doing. I did not ask for any of this. The deli on the corner does a nice bagel. I consider going in, but my stomach is not up for much. My nerves have me full. Down the street, a crowd gathers, puffing on cigarettes. They seem to be happy with their fix, chatting, laughing, ignoring danger. I can't ignore danger. I'm knee-deep in it. The watery sun blinds me, so I open my bag and search for my sunglasses. They're not there. Instead, I see the light flashing on my cell, which I'd turned to silent for my interview with Turner. Checking the call, I see it's Stephen Black on my case already. Hastening my step, I kill the call and put the phone in the pocket of my jacket. He won't stop, I know that. The guy is nervous, which makes me nervous. He'll call and call and call, probably leave a few texts, too. He has a lot to lose. I walk all the way home. When I get to the corner of my street, I step right into the aroma from the coffee shop on the corner. I realize that I've never sat in that coffee shop, that I only ever got coffee to go. I decide that today I'm going to buy a coffee and sit near a window like a normal person. I will read for a while and then survey the passers-by. People watching, imagining their stories while I drink coffee. If I'm going to prison, this is the sort of thing I want to miss. When I get back to my apartment block, Lenny is behind the reception desk reading a magazine. Ignoring the phone buzzing in my pocket, I walk over. Hi, Lenny, I say, resting my bag on the counter.
Hi, Becca.
He puts down the magazine.
Everything okay?
I was just wondering about the keys.
The keys?
He says, standing up. Lenny is about 6 feet tall and 4 feet wide. His dark hair is dusted with gray, and his skin is tough as car tire rubber. He yawns constantly, no matter what time of day it is, and when he's about to be asked a question, his face assumes a worried expression. Did you give anyone a key to my apartment last week?
Of course I didn't. I wouldn't do that without your permission.
Is there any way someone could get the key without you knowing?
No way. All the keys are kept in a safe in the basement. Why? Was someone in your apartment?
I don't know. I thought there was, but now I'm not sure. Taking my bag from the counter, I pulled the strap over my shoulder. Maybe it was just my imagination, I say, walking towards the elevator.
Are you sure? I'll come up and have a look if you want.
No, thanks, Lenny. I'm fine. I'm about to put the key in my apartment door when Jeff shouts down the corridor,
"Up for a coffee?"
Immediately, I feel happier. I'm hoping he has found out some information on Thomas Collins. Sure. I walk towards Jeff's place, and I'm about to step inside when my cell rings again. I check the caller ID. I don't recognize the number, but I guess it's him again. Stephen Black, ringing from a number I won't recognize. My hand shakes as I kill the call. I don't want to talk to him now. I don't want to talk to him ever. Inside, Jeff is standing at the kitchen island.
I haven't been able to locate a number for Thomas Collins, Becca, but I'll keep trying. Have you any more news for me?
He says, brewing the coffee. There is, I say, pulling out one of the stools. The cops called to Bridgeway and King this morning. Said they'd been to my apartment, but I'd already left, so they went to my workplace. They were asking me for an alibi.
An alibi for what?
For Saturday night.
Why Saturday night?
They think that's when she was killed.
When who was killed?
Katie Collins.
She's dead?
I can't believe he doesn't know this. Where's he been? I'm afraid so. They found her body on Sunday morning in Tree Hill Park. Some guy walking his dog.
Christ, Becca, what the fuck?
I know. And for some reason, the cops think I killed her.
What?
Well, why else would they want my alibi?
Saturday night,
he says.
Well, that's the night you were with the guy from work, isn't it?
Yes.
So you have an alibi?
He says, his wide eyes staring at me while he lifts his coffee. I guess so.
You guess so?
When I tell him I didn't give Turner Stephen Black as an alibi because he was staring at me through the glass, he goes quiet, sipping his coffee and concentrating. My eyes are glued to him, waiting for him to speak, waiting for him to tell me how big a fool I've been, how I will have to tell the detective the truth.
You have to tell them,
he says. I know, but I got nervous and—
It doesn't matter. They'll understand. Ring that detective now, Becca. Don't wait.
Jeff convinces me I have no option. The wrath of Stephen Black is nothing compared to getting chewed up by the justice system. I know he's right, so I take my phone from the end of my bag and dial her number. When I get no answer, I leave a message telling her I need to speak to her urgently. Then I hang up and wait. Right now, I feel the whole world is sitting on my shoulder, its weight threatening to break me. Turner is going to think I'm lying, that I'm inventing the alibi. She's bound to believe Stephen Black over me.
I would if I were in her shoes.
With this nightmare scenario spinning around in my head, it feels like the room is closing in. I have to get out of here.
I have to get out of everywhere. Are you okay? Becca?
Jeff moves around to my side of the counter.
You've got a funny shade of green.
He stands in front of me, but all I can see is a blur.
Becca? Becca?
When I come to, I'm lying on Jeff's sofa with a damp cloth on my forehead, Jeff sitting by my side.
Jesus, Becca, I was about to call an ambulance.
My body feels numb, so I wiggle my toes and fingers. I'm okay. Sorry about that. I couldn't help myself.
No need to apologize. It's not your fault you checked out. Are you okay now?
I'm fine, I think.
Right. Stay there for a while and rest up.
Taking the cloth from my forehead, he gets up, leaving me to close my eyes and fall into a deep sleep. The music is what wakes me. Jeff is sitting on the floor with his back resting against the sofa, with his guitar, his precious friend, in his hands. I pull myself up into a sitting position and rub my eyes, but Jeff continues to strum his guitar, singing,
"If you think this is bad, you should hear your snoring."
"What time is it?" I say, my eyes searching the room for my jacket. I need to check my cell. Jeff picks my phone from the floor and hands it to me. "Did she ring?"
"Not yet."
"What if she doesn't believe me, Jeff? What if she believes Black instead and I look like I'm making up an alibi?"
"You don't need to worry about him, Becca. He can deny it all he likes. I saw him leave the building,"
Jeff says, winking. "But what if he comes after me? Calls at my apartment?"
"Well, don't be there."
"What do you mean?"
"Stay here tonight."
I don't know how to read this. Is Jeff suggesting I sleep with him?
"Don't worry, Becca. I'm not coming on to you."
He stands up and slips his guitar back into its case. With his back to me, he says,
"You're not my type."
I'm silenced, left with my mouth open. Why am I not Jeff's type?
"You can stay in my sister's room,"
he says, pushing open the door to the second bedroom. Chapter 21. We stay up late, drinking wine and making a plan. Jeff advises me to go to Turner first thing and tell her Stephen Black is my alibi. He also suggests we go to Algiers and meet this Thomas Collins guy, find out why his wife was looking for me. This sounds a bit drastic, but I decide to keep my mouth shut for the time being and go with the flow. It's not like I have any better ideas. Now the light is streaming into the room from a crack in the curtains, highlighting the beauty of this space, the shabby chic furniture, the gentle atmosphere created by the soft colors and paintings on the wall. Jeff's sister's bed is much more comfortable than mine, with its crisp white sheets and fluffy pillows. I could stay here all day, wrapped up in someone else's comfort, wishing for someone else's life. But I can't. I've got to get to the precinct. When I leave Jeff's apartment, I close the door gently so as not to disturb him. As I turn to head for my own apartment, I see him. Stephen Black. I can't see his face, but I can tell by the suit and polished Prada shoes that it's him. My heart leaps as I reach to open Jeff's door again and realize I don't have a key. I don't want to knock because that will alert Stephen Black, so I slip into the alcove housing the fire extinguisher, squeezing my body up against the wall. The blood drains from my head. Deep breaths, Becca. The knocking continues, louder now, more aggressive. Clutching my bag to my chest, I wait, wishing for him to go away, to leave me alone. Stephen Black must be terrified his wife will find out about our little deception, that Grace will leave him, taking their baby with her. And she'd be right to do it. The guy's a creep, a bully, and a cheater. What was I thinking when I let him into my bed? The banging has stopped. Slowly, I peep out from the alcove. With a bit of luck, he got the message and retreated. But no, he's still there, running his hand through his hair before leaning to peer at the keyhole. Does he not know how they work? Then he turns this way. Quickly, I pull myself back out of sight, my heart pounding, my body shaking. Is he ever going to leave? Christ, please don't let him walk this way. I peer out again. This time he has his phone in his hand. Fuck, he's going to ring me. My head is about to burst. I pull the zip open on my bag and shove my hand inside.
Pulling the cell from my bag, I flick the silent button just as the screen lights up. I think I'm going to puke, so I suck in air and lean against the wall, watching Stephen Black's name flashing on my phone. That was close. Very close. I remain leaning against the wall for a few more minutes, breathing deeply, trying to normalize my body. Then I look out again, hoping, praying. He's standing at the elevator, staring at his phone. He calls me again. My cell lights up again. When he gets no answer, he presses the elevator button and waits. I listen for the ping of the doors before I look out again and see him step out of sight. The door closes. He's gone. Flopping to the floor, I drop my bag and rest my head in my hands. My body is still shaking. What was he planning to do? Eventually, I pull myself together and go back to Jeff's apartment. I listen outside for any sound that might tell me he's up, but there's only silence. I consider knocking, but decide not to. Jeff stayed up half the night to comfort me. The least I can do is let him sleep in. I wait until I'm sure Stephen Black is well out of the building. Then I go to my own apartment to take a shower. When I find the courage, I leave and head for the elevator. My nerves are expecting Stephen Black to be standing in front of me when the elevator door opens. But he's not. Out on the street, the morning commuters act as camouflage as I slip into the crowd. The precinct is only about 15 minutes' walk away, so I zip up my jacket to shield myself from the cold wind that seems to have arrived overnight. Winter is coming. Chapter 22. Detective Turner takes me down the corridor to an interview room. I sit, nerves jangling, at the table opposite her. This room is smaller than the last one. There's no glass window, no spare chairs, just the table, the recording machine, and the knife-edge atmosphere. The white walls do nothing to brighten the darkness of this place. I unbutton my jacket and take a deep breath.
"Is there something you want to tell me?"
she says, putting her cell on the table. "It's about last Saturday night. My alibi."
"I'm listening."
"I was with Stephen Black."
"Stephen Black,"
she says, just as her phone beeps. "Yes, he came back to my apartment after I finished my shift in Maddie's."
"Okay."
Her attention is still on the phone. She swipes the screen to read her new message.
"Just a minute,"
she says, standing up and walking to the door. 10 minutes later, there is still no sign of her returning. Has she forgotten I'm here? I'm about to go find her when the door opens and she walks back in.
"Sorry about that,"
she says, returning to her chair.
"So you've decided to change your story?"
Her eyes are searching mine. I'm afraid she doesn't believe me. "I'm telling you the truth."
"Why didn't you tell us this yesterday?"
"Because Stephen Black was staring at me during the interview and I was afraid to give his name." "But she's not interested in my alibi."
"Is there anything else you'd like to tell me?"
"Like what?"
"Like, say, where the note is."
"What note?"
"The note that Katie Collins left for you."
"I already told you I didn't get any note."
"Someone did. Someone sent Katie Collins a text arranging to meet her in Tree Hill Park. They got the number from the note."
Turner stands up, walks to the rear wall and rests against it. "Well, it wasn't me."
"Have you any idea who did contact her?"
"How would I?" I'm confused now.
"I came here to tell her about my alibi and all she's worried about is the note."
"Can't you tell from the number it came from that it wasn't my phone?"
"It came from a disposable phone." "Was it yours, Becca? Did you contact her from a burner phone?"
"No, I didn't. Look, I already told you I have an alibi. Stephen Black, why don't you believe me?"
"I do believe you. We checked the club's CCTV and saw you leave with him." So why do you still think I have anything to do with her death?
You could still have contacted her. Maybe you changed your mind after, decided Stephen Black was better company, let her show up at Tree Hill Park in the middle of the night on her own.
My head is thumping. What is Turner suggesting? That I made a date, didn't show up, and someone else killed her? Or that I made a date, am deliberately using Stephen Black as an alibi, and got someone else to kill her? I can't think straight. She's unnerving me, making me feel like I'm guilty of something. I just don't know what. There's a knock at the door, and some guy sticks his head in, telling her they have it. Her eyes light up.
I'll be right out,
she says. Then she comes back to the table and sits down across from me again.
Rebecca,
she says,
it's crucial we find that note. It was left at your address, so for now we have to conclude that you're the person who made contact.
It could have been stolen, I say.
Stolen?
She repeats. That's right. I had a break-in at my apartment last week. Nothing was missing, so I didn't call it in, but someone was definitely there. Shit. I just realized what I've said. And so does she.
Rebecca, if the note was taken from your apartment, that would mean you would have seen it. Your mailbox is in the hallway, right? You would have had to collect the note for it to end up in your apartment.
Think, Becca, think. Unless she slipped it under my door?
And did she?
Slip it under your door? I didn't see any note, Detective.
Okay.
Turner stands up. The guy who disturbed us earlier sticks his head in the room again, demanding Turner's attention. This time she relents.
You can go now, Rebecca, but I need you to keep looking for anything that might relate to Katie Collins' attempt to contact you.
The cold air hits me in the face when I leave the precinct and walk out onto the busy street. People knock off me, rushing past as I move along at a pace too slow for them. I'm in no hurry. I have nowhere to be. I decide to visit Mom, see if I can tease any more words out of her. Chapter 23. Today, there is a party at Oak Ridge. Someone has reached the big 80, or 90, or possibly even 100. It saddens me that Mom will never reach any of these milestones. She won't even make it to 60. Everyone is invited to take our loved ones down to the social room and join in the fun. When Mom was first incarcerated here, I used to walk her down to the room, sing songs and laugh, dance and eat cake. Not anymore. Now I push her in a wheelchair, watch her as she looks around the room wondering what's going on, and crumble bits of cake into her mouth. People are huddled in groups in the lobby, waiting for the festivities to begin. Dad doesn't come anymore. He thinks it's a pointless exercise. Danny never came. This would be all too backward for his high-flying world. Leaving behind the carnival atmosphere, I walk down the corridor and take the elevator to Mom's room. I don't make that wish anymore. The one where I hope she knows me. No point setting myself up for disappointment. I've lowered my standards. Now I just hope she's comfortable and in no pain. Today I find her strapped into a wheelchair, a nurse tucking a blanket around her useless legs. Her hair is brushed into a shape more suited to an 80-year-old, and someone has put lipstick on her lips.
Look, it's Rebecca,
the nurse says to Mom. Hi, Mom. I kneel down beside her, but she barely notices me, if at all. She's still smiling at the nurse and nodding her head.
Do you want to go down and sing some songs, Nancy?
The nurse asks, not expecting an answer. Then she directs her query to me.
Are you going to take her downstairs for the party? She's in good form today.
The nurse turns back to Mom.
You're feeling good today, aren't you, Nancy?
Christ, it's like she's talking to a dog. Good girl, Nancy. The enthusiasm shown by Oak Ridge staff always amazes me.
Their competence in trying to entertain the unentertainable deserves a medal. The excitement is growing as I push Mom into the social room. I will try to relax, forget what's going on in the outside world. Balloons float in every corner.